Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Teenagers now able to work in Iowa doing jobs that will raise a few eyebrows. Meanwhile, a Supreme Court win for the American Federation of Government Employees. And today on the show, we'll tell you about the dark side of the weed industry. And we'll check in with the political director of the Iowa AFL-CIO. Welcome to the Wednesday, May 31st edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. We have two guests on the show today. Our first guest comes from the state of Massachusetts. His name is Dusty Christensen. He's an independent investigative reporter and also author of this month's cover story in The Nation magazine, co-published with the organization The Shoestring, titled Exploitation, Abuse, and Death: The Dark Side of Working in the Weed Industry. This is an expose on the dangers and poor regulation of a booming business, the cannabis business, which is a $100 billion business in the United States. Now, somebody's making a whole lot of money, certainly not the workers. They face low wages, verbal abuse, union busting, life-threatening conditions. In fact, we touched on this on Workers' Memorial Day, and there was a story that the National Occupational Safety and Health picked up in their Dirty Dozen about a woman, young woman, she was under 30, who died in one of those cannabis factories, and apparently she had an allergic reaction to the cannabis dust. And there was an investigation, and, well, Dusty's going to talk about that investigation and the fact how the fine was just whittled down. Lax enforcement, sad conditions, dangerous conditions. We'll touch on all of that with Dusty Christensen. By the way, this guy is one of the founding organizers of a labor union in one of the newspapers he worked at, the Gazette in Massachusetts, where he helped organize a campaign to win the first ever union contract in that newspaper. We'll touch on that as well. Later in the show, we're going to go to Davenport, Iowa, and join the political director of the Iowa AFL-CIO. We had him on the show maybe about a month ago. That would be Al Womble. And Al has been fighting a bill dealing with child labor. The sad news is the governor there, Kim Reynolds, signed the bill into law allowing teen workers to work longer hours in jobs that were once prohibited. We're talking 16 and 17-year-olds able to serve now alcohol. It also increases from 4 to 6 the number of hours children as young as 14 can work during the school year. The governor says the law instills values in the next generation and provides opportunities for young adults to earn and save. And there's probably a lot of people that feel that same way, but we're talking about dangerous occupations. And the good news is, because of Al's work at the AFL-CIO, they were able to take the most egregious parts of that bill out. One of them was they wanted to exempt employers from liability in case something happened on the job. They took that one out. And apparently, there were a couple of industries like mining and meat packing that they wanted the kids to work in. That was eliminated as well. Mining and meat packing. Go figure. So Al Womble will be our second guest right here on America's Workforce. Now, a brief look into the world of labor. This segment brought to you by the good folks at Boyd Watterson Asset Management. You can find more at BoydWatterson.com. By a 7-2 vote, the Supreme Court, this is the U.S. Supreme Court, ruled labor law covering federal workers, including their right to organize and bargain for contracts, covers an unusual group of National Guard members, dual status employees nationwide whose jobs are part civilian, part military, and Holy Federal, even though their bosses are state National Guard generals. Listen closely. This ruling, mind you, by Justice Clarence Thomas, meant that the Ohio National Guard's then Adjutant General Mark Bergman, who was a political appointee of then Governor John Kasich, a Republican, and one of his cabinet members, could not unilaterally cancel the contract Government Employees Local 3970, that's the American Federation of Government Employees, had to cover dual status technicians by claiming they were state, not federal workers. Instead, Ohio must resume what was a contractual relationship with the local that began back in 1971 and let the Defense Department bargain with the local under terms of the Federal Labor Relations Act. It cannot unilaterally cancel union dues, withholding either, according to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's a lot of money since that time. Canceling the dues, withholding, costs local, again, this is AFGE Local 3970 and its parent union, money, though Thomas didn't detail that in his decision. No, he didn't go that far. Now, when Bergman, back in 2016, halted bargaining by refusing to recognize the union, he also wrote every dual status tech telling them there would be no further automatic union dues deductions unless they agreed to withholding. And 89 actually opted out. Thomas's ruling means that Bergman's union dues letter broke federal government labor management relations law as well. The Federal Labor Relations Authority has jurisdiction only over federal workers and agencies and petitioners. The Ohio National Guard and its adjutant general insist they are neither, Thomas wrote, but the Ohio Guard acts as a federal agency when they hire and supervise the techs in their role as civilian defense workers, even if it was only half the time. This is a pretty significant ruling. Got a comment here from AFGE's communications director. That would be Tim Kaufman. He explained, despite a more than 40-year history of bargaining with AFGE, Ohio claimed that technicians had no collective bargaining rights and that it was not bound by the Federal Service Labor Management Relations Statute, the official name for the 1978 Civil Service Reform Act. Justice Thomas explained, there is a second law involved, the Technicians Act, which makes those dual status techs federal workers whose technical employer is actually the Defense Department, the DOD, and its departments, the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, and Marines, actually sign the workers' checks, even though any National Guard state adjutant general is their top commanding officer. So certainly good news for the American Federation of Government Employees. And speaking of good news, employees at the music platform Bandcamp have voted to form a union with the Office of Professional Employees. Bandcamp, which was acquired by Epic Games last year, has positioned itself as a fan-driven digital music store that gives a greater share of its revenue to artists. The union Bandcamp United cited union-busting practices in its contest with Bandcamp and Epic. Upon the election, one of Bandcamp's co-founders issued a joint statement with the union signaling their intent to work together and negotiate in good faith. And as the Writers Guild of America enters its fifth week of striking, the strikers were joined by Los Angeles area unions from across several different industries. Teachers, tourism, hospitality workers, and public employees joined the picket line in a show of solidarity. Those unions represent over 200,000 workers, many, many with contracts expiring this year as well. The Writers Guild America is striking against the Alliance of Motion Picture and TV Producers, who have yet to agree to bargain. Can you believe that? Fifth week now, and they're not talking to each other. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Dusty Christensen will be joining us next, talking about the dark side of the weed industry. Back in a few moments.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans, and we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers, and we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Steelworkers. You can find more at USW.org.
You'd like to upgrade your fund's vision care, but you need to roll back the clock on the cost. Roll it back to the 70s. iMed offers members 76% average savings versus retail on eye exams, glasses, and contacts. Enjoy similar benefits to an indemnity plan, but with consistent savings and a better experience. Endorsed by the National Labor Alliance, iMed takes a consultative approach to tailor your vision insurance benefits. Learn more at iMed.com/union. Figures based on client data. Visit iMed.com/union for more details.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America. You can find more at CWA-union.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Real simple, AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. Let's go to our live line right now. Joining us from New England is Dusty Christensen. Dusty is an independent investigative reporter, and he has written about everything. And when I mean everything from police misconduct to changing diapers. That sounds like an interesting show in itself, but we're bringing him to the broadcast and the podcast today because of what he wrote recently in The Nation magazine about the cannabis industry. And it was titled Exploitation, Abuse, and Death, The Dark Side of Working in the Weed Industry. And the company that he referenced is a company that we talked about the show right around Workers Memorial Day at the end of April. And it was a company that they did everything possible to kind of minimize the death of one of their workers, and that's exactly what we're going to talk about on the show. Dusty Christensen, welcome to America's Workforce. How are we doing today, brother?
I'm doing good. Thanks so much for having me on the program.
So you were telling me before we started the podcast that you've been doing investigative reporting for about 12 years. What made you decide to get into this? This is a very tough field. Reporting in general is very tough today, especially when it comes to making some money, raising a family. It's so different from when I started. I started in radio back in the 1970s, and you could make a decent living at that time. How are you doing, and what made you go in that direction?
You know, it's a great question. I think it all goes back to my high school journalism teacher. I got convinced to write for the high school newspaper as a senior, and had a teacher who really pushed me to get out there and report. And, you know, I have to say that first article that was published, back then I was writing about sports and, you know, high school sports at that. That feeling you get when you get your first article published really never goes away. Every time you see your name on an article that you worked hard on, it's just the best feeling in the world. And or at least I thought at the time that was the best feeling in the world. It wasn't until my first time a number of years later getting a scoop that made a politician, powerful person really angry, that I really felt the sort of surge of energy you get when you do your job, especially as an investigative reporter, holding powerful people's feet to the fire. I had done labor organizing and was an activist through college, and went off and joined the Peace Corps after that. And in the Peace Corps, you're not really allowed to write publicly because you're a government employee. They're worried you're going to stick your foot in your mouth. And so during those 2 years, I realized just how awful it was to be sort of censored in that way. And so when I got done in the Peace Corps, I vowed that I was going to pursue journalism and pursue making powerful people and institutions upset at being held accountable. And so that's what I've been doing for the last 12 or so years.
And we need that in society. There's no doubt about that. You mentioned union organizing. Any union you want to call attention to?
Absolutely. Until recently, I worked for about 6 years at our local newspaper here in Northampton, Massachusetts, the Daily Hampshire Gazette. We unionized the shop back in 2018 with the News Guild. And since then, I've done work as a member organizer as well, helping other news workers across the country unionize and help to protect the Fourth Estate, which, as we know, is constantly under attack from everyone from the President of the United States or former now, and to big corporations and these vulture funds buying up local newspapers. So big shout out to the News Guild and all of my news worker organizers together in the News Guild.
You know, Dusty, I'm glad you brought up the News Guild. John Schlois, who heads that union, great guy, been on the show many, many times. And the company that comes to mind is Alden Capital Management, and they have gobbled up a number of newspapers, and they buy them on the cheap and they make them cheaper. They slash wages. You see a lot of reporters that they don't even have a newsroom to work in anymore. But it's really sad. And I want to say something like 1,800 newspapers have pretty much disappeared over the last 15 years. But let's talk about what you're doing right now as an independent investigative reporter. And let's get into this story involving the company Trulieve. Let me ask you, how did you get connected with this, Dusty?
You know, as a local reporter here in Western Massachusetts, I was one of, if not the only full-time reporter covering the city of Holyoke here in Western Mass. It's a city that has a long manufacturing history. It was the center of the paper industry for some time, many decades ago. And like many manufacturing towns, it had recently fallen on hard times as many of those manufacturers left town, leaving abandoned and vacant mill buildings in their wake. And the cannabis industry, surprisingly, ultimately turned out to be an option to bring into some of those old mill buildings. They were able to breathe life into some of those places, come in and set up shop in Holyoke, which has its own municipal dam system, canal system that can provide cheap electricity, which is something that the cannabis manufacturers really want. And so the leadership in Holyoke has really gone all in on the cannabis industry. Some have said that they want to turn the city, which has been called the Paper City previously, into the Rolling Paper City. And so it's really become the center of cannabis production here in our region and even in the state of Massachusetts. So as a local reporter focusing on that city, I had my eye on the cannabis industry for some time. And that is how I initially heard about the story of Laura McMurray, a cannabis worker who on January 4th, 2022, went into work like any other day and came out on a stretcher, dying several days later. After what was eventually ruled, I believe, an asthma attack. Her mother said she never had asthma before working in the facility and ultimately died of cardiac arrest. OSHA eventually came in and fined Trulieve, the company that ran that cannabis manufacturing facility. They initially fined them $35,000, but then eventually reduced the fines to $14,000 and are requiring the company to study whether ground cannabis dust should be classified as a hazardous chemical in occupational settings. And this is something that experts across the country are starting to pay attention to as more and more workers come forward in this industry with complaints about lung health and about some of the health difficulties they've had working in these cannabis growing and processing facilities, which are often indoors in former mill buildings. And so they sort of present the same dangers that both agricultural work and industrial indoor work present to workers. Obviously, there's loads of occupational hazards in those industries, and the cannabis industry is no different. So as local reporters, we decided this is the time to really dig into what working conditions look like in this booming industry that is only going to continue growing as more states and perhaps even the federal government decide to legalize adult use cannabis.
Well, there's a lot I want to unwind here, and thanks for covering this so in depth. Her death, again, Lorna McMurray, she developed an asthma attack, and she was not asthmatic. That's crazy. What about other people? Are other people getting sick over there at Trulieve?
I don't know about Trulieve, but since we published this article, I've had many people, workers in the industry, reach out to me off the record and say, you know, I never needed an emergency inhaler until I started working in a grow facility. Or, you know, I never had allergies before, but had trouble breathing after beginning working in one of these facilities. And we actually talked to an occupational health expert, Coralyn Sack, who's an associate professor at University of Washington. They have a Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences there. And she and her colleagues have done some federally funded studies of workplace exposures and health symptoms that workers in indoor grow facilities have experienced. And what they found is a high prevalence of work-related allergic and particularly respiratory symptoms in those employees. You know, the issue of what's called sensitization to cannabis or becoming allergic to it is something that they're increasingly suspicious is occupationally related. Of course, dust has long been known as a occupational danger in any number of fields. We had one cannabis worker in this piece explain to us that working in the facility he worked in was similar to his time working in construction and breathing in sawdust, coming home and feeling that gritty feeling afterwards. This is something that workers are saying they're now experiencing in the cannabis industry, and that regulators need to catch up to this quickly growing and new industry.
Yeah, silica dust is what you might be referring to, and that took a long time. We do a lot with the trades, and breathing in silica causes all kind of damage, not right away, but down the road. So God knows what's going to happen to some of these workers down the road. It's like black lung. You know, if they're working in a coal mine, it takes years for that to develop, and that mesothelioma and all the other complications that happen. I want to go back to that fine. And you said the original fine, I'm reading in your article, was $35,219 for safety violations. And then it got knocked down by $20,000 to $14,502. Why the $20,000 drop? I don't understand that. I mean, a worker died here. Did they explain that part?
You know, sadly, OSHA did not respond to numerous requests for interview for this story. I think that's really unfortunate. You know, I should note that Trulieve in 2022 posted revenues of $1.24 billion and gross profits of more than $680 million. So $35,000 down to $14,000, presumably they'd have no trouble paying either of those fines. They will be studying this issue of ground cannabis dust, although some people, including Lauren and McMurray's family, have questioned to what extent that study will be truly independent if the company where this happened is taking part in it.
Now, Dusty, what about lawsuits here? Is Lorna's family taking this to court, at least to get some compensation for what? I mean, she was only 27 years old when she died. So are they taking this to any kind of a court right now that you're aware of?
I am not aware of any lawsuit that they have filed related to Lorna's death. So I think that's still to be determined. You know, those things sometimes take time. It's unclear to me whether they plan to do so or not, but we'll obviously be keeping our eyes on it as reporters.
Yeah. Dusty Christensen joining us on our live line today. He is an independent investigative reporter. And this is pretty much of a follow-up that we did the story on Trulieve a couple of weeks back. And this is a company where they had a worker, 27 years of age. Her name was Lorna McMurray. And she was working at the facility and all of a sudden started having breathing problems. Next thing you know, a couple days later, she passes away at the age of 27. Now, there's more to the story, and you know there's a union component here because this was a non-union facility. There's some organizing going on in similar facilities here. We'll talk about that next right here on America's Workforce.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Heat and Frost Insulators Labor Management Cooperative Trust. Find out more at insulators.org/LMCT.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Auto Workers. Find more at uaw.org.
A great union requires a reliable election system. Survey and Ballot Systems is a trusted election partner with more than 30 years of expertise in managing union elections. By partnering with SBS, your union can ensure it gets an auditable process and a high level of customer service. SBS is here to help you conduct your union vote securely, transparently, and with trust building always in mind. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this next segment brought to you by the North Coast Labor Federation.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings, and we're getting more of them. So obviously, we're doing the right thing here on America's Workforce. By the way, we've got new data on the show. We are now in the top 10%, the top 10% of all podcasts in the United States. That's quite an accomplishment. It took a while to get there, but we're really, really proud of that. And don't forget, all shows are archived on awfpodcast.com. And this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency, where they connect people with employment, good employment, ulagency.org. Let's go back to Massachusetts and rejoin Dusty Christensen. Dusty is an independent investigative reporter. He did an article for The Nation magazine. He's been on radio, WNYC, on NPR, PBS. He was a staff writer for a number of years at the Boston Globe and various other newspapers. We're talking about a story involving the cannabis industry. And Dusty, I'm in your article. Well, I didn't realize how big this industry has become. I mean, marijuana moves, and it's still there's still a federal ban on marijuana, but the states didn't get that message, I guess. But anyway, it's in what, 21 states, along with Guam and Washington, D.C. They have already legalized recreational cannabis use, and there's a lot of job opportunities. So that being said, this is an industry to watch, because from what I've been reading in your article, they're not treating their people very well. So what happened in Holyoke, Massachusetts, when a worker dies after breathing cannabis dust? I can only assume that this is happening all around. Can you talk about what's going on? I see the Los Angeles Times did a story on this. Can you reference that article?
Yes. Safety and working conditions have been at the forefront of a lot of conversations that I've had with workers in the cannabis industry and others as well. Obviously, there was this death in the city of Holyoke in Massachusetts, but it's far from the only example of poor working conditions and even deaths that have happened in the cannabis industry. In December, the Los Angeles Times had an investigation. They identified 35 workers who died on cannabis farms from 2016 through 2021, mostly from carbon monoxide poisoning tied to substandard greenhouses and housing conditions. And we ourselves at the Nation were able to get leaked documents showing at least two cannabis companies here in Western Massachusetts that have themselves identified significant levels of mold and particulate matter in their own workplaces after they hired environmental consultants to test their buildings. So these are issues that cannabis workers across the country are facing. And unfortunately, they are facing those conditions while not getting paid much of anything to do so. A new report from the hiring platform for the cannabis industry, Vangst, found that in 2022, trimmers, post-harvesters, packagers, those sorts of folks in the cannabis industry made between $16 and $20 an hour nationwide for that really physically demanding work. That's not a living wage out here in Massachusetts, in Western Massachusetts, and I suspect it's not a living wage in much of the country. And so many cannabis workers have been talking amongst themselves about the low wages that they face, some of the physically grueling work, and particularly the high profits that so many of these big companies are pulling in while continuing to pay their workers these kinds of wages. So it is unsurprising that some workers have taken the step of unionizing, in particular with the Teamsters, with UFCW, the United Food and Commercial Workers. Those two unions in particular have been unionizing cultivation, post-harvest workers, as well as the folks working, for example, at the cash register and dispensaries across the country. Those folks have, the cannabis industry is similar to journalism and other industries in that people who go into that industry are really excited about it. They're really passionate about cannabis. Maybe they were a medical card holder or somebody who had grown for a number of years and are really excited to get into this brand new industry. And so when they learn about the conditions that they're forced to work in this industry, I think a lot of people become jaded and realize that they want to take matters into their own hands. So, of course, one of the ways to do so is to unionize. There is still not tons of movement on that front. Obviously, most private sector workers, the vast majority of them in the United States, continue to be non-union. But those who have organized and spoke to us said they're hoping to change that.
Yeah, you point that out in the article. In fact, going back to Trulieve, that's the operation where the woman died. Their CEO, I like this, Kim River, said the company is proud of the many protections in place for its workers. And she said that Trulieve is rolling out a temporary training program alerting workers to the potential allergic reactions that they might have in the workplace. Now, that being said, the workers, I'm sure they're taking that with a grain of salt. They started a unionization drive over there, and apparently the CEO kind of put the brakes on it. I mean, did they get into a real ugly union busting campaign, to your knowledge there?
I am not quite sure what was happening internally. I know they didn't reach the stage where they were filing for an election or anything of the sort, but Rivers herself made an appearance at least one Trulieve facility in Massachusetts. Organizers had said there had been some attempts at some of the other ones as well. And she showed up at those facilities amidst those attempts, as I understand it. And, to date, Trulieve, at least here in Massachusetts, is not unionized. So this is something that we've discovered that not just Trulieve is engaging in, but other large cannabis companies across the country and in our region in particular. They've hired these anti-union consultants and law firms to dissuade workers from organizing within the workplace. Some big companies, including Holistic, that operates out here in Western Mass and elsewhere in the country, as well as INSA, it's another organization here, a cannabis company in Western Massachusetts that also has a national footprint. We discovered through federal filings that those organizations had hired union busting consultants. I'm sure others have as well. There are loopholes, as you, I'm sure, know, in the federal law requiring these union busting consultants and companies to file federal disclosures about their activities. That doesn't always happen. And so what we were able to show in our article through those federal filings is probably just the tip of the iceberg.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I see in 2021, one of the companies, Curaleaf, paid an anti-union consultant $35,000, according to those federal records. We should do a shout-out here. The Teamsters are sponsors of this show, and I see Local 665. They're in Santa Rosa, California, and they do cultivation and post-harvest over there at the Floris Terra Cannabis Plant. They voted to unionize with Local 665 in October. So good job by the Teamsters. Teamsters, very vigilant union there. So I would imagine if you get one win and another one, it's going to spread, just like we're seeing at, you know, Starbucks, Trader Joe's, and all those places that are organizing right now. The hard part, obviously, is getting the first contract. So let me ask you about this, Dusty. We're speaking with Dusty Christensen, and this is an article that's posted in the Nation magazine, Exploitation, Abuse, and Death, the Dark Side of Working in the Weed Industry. The cannabis industry is booming, but workers say they face low wages, lousy bosses, and life-threatening conditions. And in one condition, a worker, Lorna McMurray, died on the job after breathing cannabis dust. And they took her out in a stretcher. 3 days later, she's dead. She was an only child, and she was only 27. So since this article posted, you kind of touched on this in the first segment, is it starting to explode? Are workers beginning to speak out? Because that's the only way we're going to get change. I mean, the union can make changes, especially when it comes to safety and protective gear. You take a look at the coal mines from years ago. I mean, they didn't have any protections, but because the union came in, they got protection. Still a dangerous job, don't get me wrong. But what are you hearing right now? Are more people saying, hey, Dusty, we got a problem over here? Is that happening?
You know, I am hearing from a number of cannabis workers who are talking about the need for more workplace democracy, the need to move forward with efforts to unionize. And, you know, obviously we're in this unique moment, it feels like, in recent history where unionization, it's not quite on the uptick in the sense that more workers are unionizing. I think the number or percentage of unionized workers fell again this past year, a continued decline. But there is this sense of increasing militancy and this increasing sense of workers being fed up with having no voice in the workplace. And just like in the newspaper industry, as you mentioned, in grocery stores and Starbucks across the country, this is happening in cannabis companies as well. So the example you brought up of Santa Rosa, where the Floris Terra cannabis workers voted to unionize, you know, out here in Holyoke, the city we mentioned earlier in the segment, there was one cultivation facility that was able to unionize. We have card check here in Massachusetts for agricultural workers, so they were able to do that by filing cards. And increasingly, there have been these efforts at unionizing. That's why we see these anti-union efforts cropping up across the country. You know, at a time in our history where so few public sector and private sector workers are unionized, I think, you know, a lot of workers, it takes a bit of work and momentum to get to that point to go forward with a union because there's such little experience of doing that. But as more and more people start to unionize, we're seeing it in the newspaper industry that I was in for so long, it starts to spread like wildfire. So I wouldn't be surprised if the same begins to happen in the cannabis industry as more and more of these shops start to decide to take matters into their own hands and to organize themselves.
Well, Dusty, thank you for coming to the broadcast and the podcast today. And I'll tell you, I think you woke up a whole lot of people. Hopefully we'll continue to delve into the cannabis industry and find more of what's wrong. And hopefully the states will take it upon themselves to make these places safer and the federal government as well. But that's a tall order. DustyChristensen.com is the website. Do you have a lot of your articles posted right on your website, Dusty?
I do, and I post everything on Twitter. You can find me there at DustyC123.
Okay. Anything else you want to call attention to before we go that you're working on? Maybe give us a little sneak preview?
There's always things to hold people accountable here on Western Massachusetts. You know, I should note that this area of the country, though it is small, has recently become a bit of a hotbed for union organizing. The very first Trader Joe's in the country unionized just down the road here in the town of Hadley. I believe that was just last year. And then last month, or maybe it was even this month, workers at a Barnes & Noble and just right down the street from that Trader Joe's voted to move forward with the process of unionizing. They're just the second in the country to do so. So there is a real building of union militancy out here in Western Massachusetts. And we at The Nation, a local news outlet I work with as well, that co-published this article, The Shoestring, will continue to pay attention to it. So be on the lookout for our reporting as those things continue to move forward.
Good stuff. Something in the air over there. No doubt about that.
That's right. Something in the water.
and that too. Yeah, yeah. Well, you take care. Stay safe. And let's talk down the road. I'm sure you'll have more to bring. Okay?
Thanks so much.
Okay. Do check out that website, DustyChristensen.com. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to go to the state of Iowa and join political director Al Womble of the Iowa AFL-CIO. The governor signed a bill into law allowing teen workers to work in restaurants serving alcohol. There's a lot more to the legislation. We'll talk to Al about that next.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialists, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
Hi, this is Liz Schuler, president of the AFL-CIO, and I am a huge fan of Flash and America's Workforce Radio and podcast.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Iron Workers. You can find more at ironworkers.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
America's Workforce is presented by the Laborers International Union of North America. Feel the power right now at LIUNA.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Real simple, AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this portion of America's Workforce sponsored by iMed. Switching to managed vision care may save your fund money and deliver a better experience. So here's what you do. Go to imed.com/union and you will learn a whole lot more. Well, as we were telling you at the beginning of the show, they changed the law in the state of Iowa with regard to child labor. Joining us on our live line, we had him on the show a couple of weeks ago. He worked hard to make this the best bill possible. When it comes to labor rights, well, they take a back seat in a number of states, and Iowa is one of those states. But they're not alone. There's at least a dozen, maybe 20 states where the legislatures, mostly GOP supermajorities, are trying to get as many young people, we're talking 14-year-olds, to work, in some cases serving alcohol. Let's go to our live line right now and join Al Womble. Al is the political director of the Iowa AFL-CIO, iowaafl-cio.org. Al, well, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, and why don't you just tell us where we are with this piece of legislation, because your governor I guess, signed it into law, so it's now official. So welcome back to the show. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, thank you for having me. So, yes, it was unfortunately signed into law by a governor we like to call Corporate Kim Reynolds. And, you know, I want to start out by saying, you know, a lot of people worked hard to try to get some of the most egregious parts of this bill out of it. The Iowa Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, you know, we collaborated with several different organizations throughout the state to try and, you know, lobby against this bill, hold petitions, rallies, everything that we could. And some of the things that we were got out of there is that, you know, the initial bill sought to exempt employers from any civil liability for injury, sickness, or death of teenage workers arising from the business's neglect or omission. And, you know, that had been removed. The initial bill also waived hazardous work protections for 14 and 15-year-olds in work-based learning or work-related programs. And it also allowed young children to work in more hazardous occupations, such as, you know, shipping and assembly and meat packing, slaughtering houses, rendering facilities. You know, we were able to get some of that out. And, you know, one of the things that, that unfortunately is still in the bill, but it has changed, you know, allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to serve alcohol. But at least, you know, we have been able to narrow that provision a bit so that it can only, that work can only be done in restaurants and not in bars. And that the teens that are going to do that have to attend sexual harassment training, and employers must report incidents of sexual harassment to the teen's parents, and employers must notify insurers. And then some of the amendments also helped cut down the amount of hours they initially were wanting individuals to work. So we did get some terrible stuff out of the bill. Now, unfortunately, yeah, you're right that, you know, it's going to allow, you know, young children to work more hours during the day, during the school year, work even more hours during the years that school is, or during the, excuse me, the time that school is out of session. You know, we're not happy about that hour either. But, you know, some of these provisions directly contradict Department of Labor law. And some of our senators has, or some of our state senators that are our union-friendly people, you know, wrote to the Department of Labor, and they wrote back and said, yeah, some of these provisions are against, you know, Department of Labor mandates. So hopefully we get some assistance on that end if somebody starts breaking some rules out there. But so I'm pretty happy about some of the work we were able to do, even though we weren't able to kill this monstrous bill. Like I said, it's turned from a pure nightmare into just a bad dream. So
yeah, you try to make the best out of a bad situation. You mentioned right. Federal government here and labor
yeah.
law.
Mm-hmm.
I got mm-hmm. the sense that there might be a possibility of some kind of, I don't know if you would call it an appeal. We're not dealing with a court here, but we're talking about the mm-hmm. power of the federal government that could say, wait a minute, Iowa, you went a little too far. Are you indicating that may happen then?
You know, I, at this early stage, you know, it's just been signed into law. And, you know, I would hope that there would be federal agencies that would have the wherewithal to step in. And, you know, if some of these violations take place, or if somebody actually says, hey, I'm going to go by what the state law tells me and, you know, do some of these things that are against Department of Labor law, the Department of Labor would step in. But, you know, myself being a former safety administrator, one of the things I'm concerned about is just like with OSHA, we don't have enough funding to have enough investigators to get out there and review every situation. You know, I'm also concerned about that in this type of situation. So it's going to be up to, you know, diligent people, our allies, people that we've collaborated with earlier in the year to make sure if something is going wrong, that we find out about it, we report it, and we help move the process along. You know, diligence never stops. You know,
right.
when you're looking at protecting kids, making sure you're protecting labor rights, for goodness sakes. You can't slack off and have an off day and say, you know, today I don't feel like it. Reminds me of something I read by Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, when we were having the Montgomery bus boycott. You know, an old woman was asked, aren't you tired of walking all the time? And she said, you know what, My feet may be tired, but my soul is rested. And we got to feel the same way when it comes to protecting labor rights. You know, we might be tired, but you know what? I'm ready to go back out there and do it again the next dang day.
Al, you're talking about kids serving alcohol. I want to pick up on that part because the last couple of weeks had to be really interesting. I would only assume that there had to be a number of parents saying, hey, wait a minute. You want my kid to serve alcohol? Okay, it's not a bar, but it's a restaurant. That had to be some interesting testimony, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that they continued to push this through the legislature and then have the governor sign it, when there were indeed many parents from across the state of Iowa who said, this is bad. We don't want this. We as Iowans don't need this. And yet they still pushed it through. And, you know, people just find it terrible that there are going to be, you know, 16 and 17-year-olds, even if it's in a restaurant situation, you know, serving alcohol to people. There's not a good ending I can see to that scenario. You know, at some point in time, something's going to happen. And, you know, gosh, protecting our youth, protecting workers should be one of our top priorities.
Absolutely.
And sending them, you know, young kids, there's 16 and 17-year-olds into this scenario, just is not appropriate at all.
No.
There are, yeah, a lot of angry parents about this. A lot of different organizations, you know, that have been angry about this. A lot of our different religious leaders across, you know, the state of Iowa are very upset about this. When I spoke to some of them initially, they thought I was joking when I mentioned to them they're writing into a bill to allow 16 and 17-year-olds to serve alcohol. And they thought I was kidding about that. And then when they looked up the law and saw that, they're like, you know, this can't happen. So,
and that's the problem today, because the media is so confusing in social media that people don't even believe what's going on until it's too late. Now the bill is signed into law. Let's talk about your governor here. Governor Reynolds, we're speaking with Al Womble, who is a political director of the Iowa AFL-CIO. Governor Kim Reynolds says that the law instills values in the next generation and provides opportunities for young adults to earn and save. Al, how do you react to that?
Well, my first reaction is, you know, when I was young myself, like many of the people who spoke on this bill, both before and against, you know, a lot of us worked different jobs when we were young, like, you know, mowing lawns, shoveling sidewalks, maybe working at a Dairy Queen, something like that, or snacking groceries at your local grocery store. Hey, that's not an issue. Kids can work at that. But now we're specifically about putting children into hazardous job atmospheres, in the atmospheres where they're serving alcohol. And that's not really teaching our kids anything about saving for their future when you're putting them into low-wage situations and hazardous work. If you want to teach kids about, you know, properly saving and you know, work ethic and stuff like that, why don't we dump more money into our school systems and actually teach kids things like civics and personal finance? I think that would do a lot more to help improve our young people as opposed to having them work in meatpacking plants or places like that. And not only that, here's the other thing. If you actually paid people a decent living wage with good union jobs, we wouldn't have to worry about trying to get our children to fill these jobs. There would be enough adults lining around the block to fill these jobs themselves without us resorting to, you know, making children do this.
No,
I'm a little hyped up about this, you can tell. It's you know, when you say saving for their future, majority of the kids who are going to be in this type of position working these jobs are going to be the kids who are from families that have to go out and work these jobs, because their parents aren't making enough to make ends meet.
Right.
This isn't going to be somebody whose father is a lawyer, doctor, or a chief. This is going to be parents who are saying, hey, I need my kid to work because I can't pay the bills because I'm not being paid a living wage at a good union job.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's really going on here. So those, all those dollars that these kids are making that supposedly is going to go into savings isn't going to go there. And, you know, without proper union protections on these jobs, you know, it's not going to teach them anything about a work ethic other than, you know, workers can still be exploited by management. That's what it's
going
to teach them.
That's exactly what's going to happen. Well, Al, thank you for joining us here on the show today. You did the best job you could. I mean, you're fighting a tidal wave here, and it's not just Iowa. Like I indicated, it's happening in a good chunk of America in there. So hold your head high, my brother. Keep moving forward, and we'll see what the federal government can do on this, okay?
All right. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Okay. Al Womble, political director for the Iowa AFL-CIO, iowaafl-cio.org is our website. That'll be it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, we'll check in with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, their airline division, and we'll tell you all about the Bank of Labor. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.